Welcome to GRE Snacks, snackable episodes about the GRE exam and graduate school admissions. I'm Tyler, the founder of Achievable, and we have an affordable GRE course that includes everything you need to ace your GRE exam, which is a full textbook, videos on key topics, tons of GRE questions backed by our memory-enhancing algorithm, a built-in study planner and essay grader using machine learning, and full-length practice exams. You can try this out for free by going to achievable.me, and if you like it, be sure to use the code podcast so you can get 10% off at checkout. Now, let's get started. Today, we have Karthik from MBA Link, and Karthik, I'd love if you could just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your company as well.
Sure. Thank you for having me on, Tyler. So, I'm Karthik Rajaswaran, based in Singapore and part of MBA Link. I am somebody who's grown up all around the world. I was born and raised across three countries in Africa, Kenya, Botswana, and South Africa. Family are originally from India. And ever since I went to business school myself, I've lived between Singapore, London, and back in Africa. Had the privilege of traveling around the world too. So I'm hoping to bring some international perspectives to the discussion today.
Yeah, I'm really excited for that too. Also, you're like the poster INSEAD graduate, right? Like,
I think that was definitely in my favor, yes.
At one point, I think I wanted to go to INSEAD because I thought it was a very cool looking school. And it, like someone said to me, like, but you've only lived in America. You're not going to get in. I was like, oh, okay. That's very cool though. So today we're going to be talking about, you know, MBA application strategies for all types of international candidates, right? Your colleague Lawrence talked about Asian candidates back in the day. We've also had episodes for other groups. But I think, you know, given your sort of wide background in a variety of countries and locations, I'm really excited to have this conversation today and kind of some general tips.
Sure.
So when you're talking to people, sort of where do you start, right? Like, what's maybe the first or most top of mind tip that you have?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, one of the most important things we try to establish with any interested candidate or applicant is where they want to study themselves. Right? And of course, the vast majority of candidates are usually interested in the top American programs, famously known as the M7 or the T15, meaning the top 15 or top 20 programs, and then a few in Europe as well. So it's usually the sort of same suspects of schools that people are interested in applying to. But increasingly, you're getting schools in Asia, there are a couple in Africa as well, that are coming onto people's radars as target schools. So I think that's one of the first things we try to establish, because that then cascades down into all of the factors we have to consider in terms of the candidate's profile, as well as their post-MBA opportunities too. And so when you're looking at, let's say again, like the typical applicant who's interested in a Harvard, Stanford, MBA, or one of the other very top programs, we really try to dig in, right? Firstly, do you understand the sort of difficulty of getting accepted into one of these programs? That's pretty standard. But now if you're potentially, and I'm speaking again from the perspective of an international client or candidate, irrespective of where in the world you're from, knowing that all of these schools are looking for international candidates, they want to have a healthy mix of domestic and international candidates. But then even within the international candidate pool, you want to have a good mix of people from different countries. Now, as you sort of alluded to early on, INSEAD is very explicit that they try not to have more than 10% of representation from any single school. From any single country.
Right.
Or nationality, let's say, right? Whereas other schools are not as pedantic or particular about that, but nonetheless, they want to have a healthy mix. So if we feel that your applicant profile is part of a very crowded pool, and the two cliches or three cliches at the moment really are Indian male engineer from India, so that's a very crowded applicant pool, or East Asian male or female, and typically with a technical or finance background as well, are very crowded applicants. Meaning there are very many people who have very similar profiles on paper, you're competing against. And helping you stand out is one of the most important things we then start looking into. So I'll pause there.
No, that's good. And I mean, that makes sense now why they did not recommend applying to INSEAD as an American. but also, that's so fascinating. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed, we track, like, the GRE puts out, like, a report every year that talks right. about, you know, how many students are taking the GRE and, like, from where. And the GRE numbers in India have, like, tripled in the last 4 years or something. Like, it's gone from, like, 75 or 100,000 to, like, 300,000 people per wow. year. Yeah, so it's pretty remarkable. I mean, I think that it's also funny because what you mentioned, which is like, you know, Indian engineer and, you know, East Asian, like finance or tech, I think a lot of, I don't know, I guess I'll just say this and hopefully it's not too bad to say, but like, those are some of the most ambitious groups of people sort yes. of period, right? Yes. So it's funny that like all the ambitious people kind of chased the same very ambitious careers, whether that's cultural or otherwise, I don't know. It's probably both cultural and financial, right?
Yeah.
But then it led to them all competing against each other for the same amount of quote unquote spots in these schools, right? That's yeah. not exactly fair, right? I mean, one of the arguments against affirmative action in America, which was recently struck down, was the idea that if affirmative, like that affirmative action hurt Asian candidates, which it did, right? Because a lot of them had very good scores. So it's like, it's really interesting that you mentioned that those are tough groups. I mean, what advice do you have for, you know, either people in those groups, like, cause you mentioned, yeah, let's start there. Like for people yeah. in these, call it like high achieving, but also in the MBA applicant pool crowded yes. groups, how do you brainstorm with a client about standing out?
Sure. That's a yeah. great question. So I think it's again a two-step process. So step one, as we always try to position it, is you need to have the core essentials of a profile that gets your foot in the door, or in application terms, gets the admissions committee to read your full profile and candidacy, right?
Right.
So you know how people joke that, hey, the degree you get is a foot in the door to the interview, right? But at the end yeah. of the day, how you perform in the interview is up to you. So that's kind of how we position this. And mm-hmm. I think the challenge that a lot of international candidates in particular face, but especially those from the competitive pools, they assume that it's all about the quantitative credentials, if you would, right? So test score, hey, I worked at this company. Hey, I was earning this much. I'm on a track towards management and or partner, etc. But actually, that will get the admissions committee interested in your profile, saying like, okay, cool, this person has, I guess, the core essentials we'd expect from an academic perspective, from a professional or career perspective. However, who are they as a person? What are their real ambitions and motivations? How will they contribute to our class? How will they contribute to our alumni pool? And how are they going to help other people in future, right? So there are a lot of mm-hmm. qualitative aspects about you and your life as a candidate or a student that are incredibly important. And those are actually the major differentiators, right? Running test prep yourself, I'm sure you know that the very top schools, you kind of need minimum scores to really be considered seriously. Now, they'll never say there's an official correct. Minimum score. But when you see the median scores that are, you know, for students at many of the top programs, you have a decent sense as to what they're looking for. So mm-hmm. that's really how we position, right? So then when you really want to get into people's stories and background, I think some of the most important things are your motivation for why an MBA and why now. And really what schools are looking to see and understand is, are you going to be somebody who is successful and driven and motivated irrespective of whether you get an MBA or not? So the MBA mm-hmm. should ideally be an accelerant in your journey, as opposed to something you're just doing, you know, to check box your life or because you want something prestigious next to your name, right? And I think this is the advantage that people who are applying from less represented parts of the world really have, in that their stories are by default likely to be unique. But then what needs to happen is that it needs to be positioned well, because the schools mm-hmm. also need to know that you've really thought about what your opportunities are going to be post MBA, whether it's entrepreneurship or whether it's, again, going into a sort of more traditional job structure and career. Because if you're applying from a country that basically doesn't have too many economic opportunities, and you say, hey, I want to go back to that country and have an impact, well, if you go back immediately, you may not earn enough to be able to pay off the loans you took out for your MBA, right? Mm-hmm. And so does it make more sense for you to work somewhere else before you go back? And they want to see that you're thinking through all of these things. So that entire or holistic perspective is what we encourage candidates to think about and work on them with.
Yeah. I mean, I think also you said, like, why get an MBA and why now? I think that the why now is super important, right? Like, why is this the fulcrum in the sort of up and to the right chart where, you know, this will be the thing that kicks off, like,
the inflection really point accelerated, in your
life. The inflection point. The other thing that I've heard a lot of people talk about is, like, why this school? Right.
Yes.
I mean, I think every school wants to be flattered, I guess, but also, you know, they read probably 1,000 flattering essays a week. So it's more like, you know, how is this school specifically relevant to your journey? Right.
Yes. That's incredibly important. And as we touched on, so one of the things, again, we actively work on with any candidate is fit. So fit for you and fit for the specific schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say that you have certain ambitions and goals, but in principle, if you get accepted to any top program, you'll have a lot of opportunities at hand. But from your personality and the value of the school, values of the school, which industries maybe they have a stronger affiliation with, the location I think is also incredibly important. Like, so it's one thing to say you're in the US, for example, you're in Europe. Then specifically which state or city, do you like the culture of the city? What kind of experience would you want? Just giving you something like an anecdote from my own personal experiences. When I was evaluating or considering different MBA programs, I'd fortunately visited the US. I visited, because I was in New York first, I visited Columbia and then NYU. And then I happened to visit the West Coast and then happened to go to Stanford and UC Berkeley class. And it was so clear to me that I did not want to study in New York, right? So I didn't want like a very busy city experience. I wanted to be in somewhere like close to the coast, in the hub of tech, etc. So the only US schools that I applied to were Stanford and us, irrespective of the prestige of some of the others, right? Mm-hmm. And then, as I mentioned, I'd applied to INSEAD, which for me was still my top choice because of the very international focus that they had. And I felt like I'd be a very good fit for that, which I think in the end turned out to be the case. So similarly, most people come to us with the generic, hey, I want this top school because it's prestigious. And, you know, like everybody will recognize the name. And it's like, yes, but you also realize there are many other potential better fits for you. And let's really uncover that. And also, these names will also be recognized all around. You need to keep that.
Right. Well, it's also the fact that, I mean, if you're sitting there and you're applying to, you know, HBS, GSB, and the other ones in the top seven, so is everyone else, right? So at a certain point,
exactly.
Like, you're, I don't want to say wasting your time. It depends on your test scores and your resume. You might not be wasting your time. But also, it's like, it's productive to think outside of the very well-worn, you know, top seven path and think instead about, like, you know, okay, I really want to do, like, I really want to get the best marketing education, right? So, like, for me, like, Kellogg is one of those ones that's, like, very, very good at marketing, considered probably top three, and is not generally, like, the first thing people think of when they think of graduate school in general. Right. Yeah. And so I think that there's like a lot of, and it's still a great school. Like, I think it's like top 20 overall anyway, but it's just like, that's sort of like where you need to start thinking about, like, okay, with my specialty, with what I want to do afterwards, with what city I want to be in. You mentioned you didn't want to be in New York. You know, the opposite might be that you do want to be in New York. So you're going to make sure like that you've got some New York schools on the list. All that stuff is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mean, that's something we'll touch on later. But yes, also thinking about your post-MBA opportunities and mm-hmm. which schools are better aligned to the industries you're looking at are crucial. One other thing I do want to touch on with regard to international candidates, especially for those coming from countries that are, as I mentioned, not very economically strong, or if you're coming from a country where you don't have a very strong currency that you earn in, you are almost certainly going to have to get a scholarship and or take out a loan. So I think that's another really important thing that many international candidates probably don't think about initially is which schools are more likely to offer you a scholarship. And if you get two good offers between, let's say, GSB and Wharton with a scholarship, right? I think that's like a common experience. So GSB, zero scholarship, Wharton, 70-80% scholarship, right? Oh, wow. We would strongly encourage the student to consider the program that's giving them a scholarship. Because that's
well, especially when they're both like really, really good, right? Like I think sure. what it's
okay, maybe I should have used an example where the rankings or prestige are a bit further apart, right?
Right, yeah.
But that's not something to scoff at, let's say. The scholarship is a key component, and that's actually an active part of the application as well. I think, of course, when you're writing your core essays and putting your application forward, you don't necessarily want to highlight that. You want to highlight what you're going to bring to the table. You're not necessarily highlighting your financial standing too much. However, when you do apply for scholarships, which are open to pretty much all candidates, you do have to motivate for the scholarships and being very clear on the reasons why a scholarship will benefit, not just now, but in the long term as well, is incredibly important. And that's something I think more and more people need to tap into and think about with their applications from the very beginning. And then, right. of course, there are fortunately now more financial service providers. A very well-known one in the MBA or graduate studies world is called Prodigy Finance, which was actually born out of Seattle, funny enough. But they've done a great job of providing, I'd say, pretty good loans, meaning substantial amounts and with relatively good terms to a lot of people going to top MBA programs and other graduate programs as well. But there are hopefully more and more such financial service providers coming up in different countries. And so tapping into those people well in advance of your application as well is very important. Because at the time of submitting your application, if you can say to a school, hey, I've already secured X amount as a loan, the schools also feel more confident that, okay, you will be able to pay and afford for program, as opposed to saying, oh, yeah, you know, I'll figure all of this out later. Right? That's not the most, I'd say, encouraging tactic or approach to take for the schools or even from an
interesting perspective. So like Prodigy Finance, my assumption was that they gave you a loan because you got into INSEAD or whatever, but they're taking a bet on you even before you get admitted to any schools.
That's an important clarification. So I think you can get sort of provisional sense of how much you may get, but then the amount that is dispersed only happens once you get accepted to certain schools. So you're very right about that. But see, there is a bit of a time lag between when a school sends you an offer and then when you need to make your deposit payment and actually sort of really finalize your enrollment, right? Because unfortunately, there is a drop-off with many of the schools wherein they may send you an offer, but then you have a couple of months to sort of make your first deposit and make all of your plans and arrangements for traveling to the new country, finding accommodation, so on and so forth. And unfortunately, students do drop off during that phase because they're just not able to make the finances. So if you have those preliminary conversations and you're like, hey, I'm applying to these schools, what could I potentially stand to get in terms of the size of the loan? You can get an initial sort of soft feedback. Then once you do get accepted and show them your acceptance mail or letter, it's like, okay, cool. We can give you this much. The Got process it. May have changed. I should double check that, but that's generally the structure.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I wasn't asking you to be an expert on financing for this one, but that's all very interesting. And I mean, it's funny because as an American applying to American institutions, the idea that we would have trouble funding it never really came up. Mm. But that's like, it totally makes sense that it's more of a concern for international students, right?
Definitely.
I mean, I don't know if American student loans for graduate school are covered by like the student loan laws. But student loans in America, for better or for worse, are basically guaranteed. Even if you try to default, you can't. Because that was like the first thing that happened. They instituted like student loan protection in the 50s.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of law school students graduated law school, immediately went bankrupt, wiped the loans out, and then just like went through their life. And like all the schools were like, what? So they made it so now your loans can't go away, even if you go through bankruptcy. But of course, that means that we have over $1 trillion in student loan debt. Most of it's undergrad. Yeah. But anyway, so that's all very interesting. And that's an unnecessary side tangent, but I digress. So the other thing I wanted to ask you about, you were talking about, moving, getting accommodations, like doing that internationally is tough, right? Like I've lived abroad a couple of times and, most of the time it's hard to get there. You don't really like you usually can't arrive that much earlier than when your school starts. Yep. And you also have to like apartment hunt, and then you have to move in, you have to move all your stuff, which usually involves a trip back and or something, or you just bring what you can and then and so like what is your advice for all that, right? Like how do you advise students kind of navigate that part of the process?
Fantastic question. I think we're very lucky to live in the internet age where you can actually communicate with a lot of people from halfway across the world instantly, right? So you have a lot of forums and groups created by current students as well as alumni from many of the schools you're potentially interested in. And once you get access to those, you'll get recommendations on, hey, these are the best like apartments or buildings to look for. And hey, I know the landlord. And so if you're interested, get in touch with me. I'll introduce you to the landlord. So you'll have all of these little groups which go a long, long way. And then another hack or trick is to buy stuff from students who are leaving at the time that you're joining, right? Instead of having to go and buy new stuff or carry a lot of stuff from home, carry your essentials, you know, like the clothes you love and some of your favorite items and so on. But if you're looking for appliances like a fridge or a microwave or even a bicycle to get around wherever you may be living, just get a secondhand one or maybe 10th hand one from a student who's leaving around the time that you'll be, right? Because usually semesters end and then you have maybe 1 month break or something. The next one starts. I'm speaking from experience because that's how I got a hold of the bicycle that I had and some of the other things.
Did you give it to someone else afterwards too?
Yes, I did. So I'm pretty sure it's still being used by somebody all these years on.
Right? That's awesome.
So that I think goes really a long way. You're right that you can't arrive too far in advance. So I think a lot of us arrived maybe a week or two before semester started, then had the chance to settle in. But some other people genuinely arrived the day of maybe. I think also because you're going to an MBA program, most people are already in their sort of mid to late 20s. You've had some life experience, and so you'll feel more comfortable usually traveling by yourself and getting set up by yourself. But then some people also do feel, hey, I would like my parents or family to come with me, and that's also totally fine, which I think if you can do that helps a lot, of course. But if you're going by yourself, the great thing is you'll have the support of a lot of your classmates, peers, and friends. But definitely tap into the alumni network. Get tips and tricks. Where are the best places to rent or find a place? Where should you do your grocery shopping? Where should you eat? Where do you, again, get your goods? So there is no shortage of resources, fortunately. I think you just have to be proactive about it. And also come across as a personable and friendly human being, right? People will be more inclined to help you if they see that, hey, I'm just new. I'm sort of from a place where I don't have much background or knowledge of the city or country.
Yeah, great. And then what haven't we covered so far? Like what other things for applying internationally to MBA programs did you want us to cover today?
I'd say, well, I guess two regions in the world that are not that well represented at a lot of the top MBA programs. Number one is Africa. Having been there myself, I think, or having come from there myself, in our class of 500 people at INSEAD, I think we had 10 people from Africa. So from a percentage or proportion perspective, it's severely underrepresented, right, relative to the total population of. I'd say the second such region, and probably equally tied, are Southeast Asia and South America or Latin America. Right? Now, most of the programs seem to have a lot of people in the class that come from Brazil. This is in the top US schools as well. And then similarly, from Southeast Asia, I'd say Singapore is probably overrepresented relative to its size and population. Whereas Indonesia, right, a country of almost 300 million people, barely has two or three people in a single class. Right.
Right.
So unfortunately, part of the challenge there is financial, but I think the other is awareness and confidence. So financial is just a reality. I think in Indonesia or in many of the African countries and some of the Latin American countries too, people are scared about the financial cost of taking on an MBA, which is going to cost $200,000, $300,000 all in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back post-MBA, you'll be lucky to earn $100,000 a year, top line. Mm-hmm. This is pre-tax. Because if you're earning $100,000 a year in one of those countries, you're probably in the top 5% of income levels in those countries. Whereas in the US, like, people will be like, oh, no, I'm not going to go to business school. I'm not going to make that much post-MBA. So that is unfortunately a major challenge. So many of them try to get sponsored by the companies they're working at, hopefully. But the other is a confidence one. And I think that's the major one to really address, right? And a lot of people worry that, oh, I'm from X country or I'm from X region. Like, why would they take me seriously? And like, do I have what it takes to compete at the very best? And the simplest answer I can give to that is ability is evenly distributed around. Everybody has ability and potential. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. what is not is opportunity. And so mm-hmm. if you are inclined and you have the motivation, you definitely should take the chance. Of course, you need to do the work, but don't feel that because I'm from a certain part of the world, I don't stand a chance at the top. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. If you're a good candidate, they're more inclined to want to see if you have the potential to succeed at the top. So basically, I'd say, yeah, don't be afraid. Of course, the financial challenges are real, but definitely explore it further. And an MBA at a top program can be truly transformative, not just for yourself, but for many of the people around you. What I've mm-hmm. found is it's almost like pass the ladder down situation, right? More and more people become encouraged to want to go to a top program and pursue a certain career because they see somebody like them or somebody from the same school or city or country has gone and done it before, right? So I only knew of one alumni from INSEAD alumni from Botswana, and I was very lucky that I got to meet him, and I met him in my teens when he had just come back from his program, and that mm-hmm. planted such a strong imprint on me that I was certain that, hey, 10 plus years on, I would love the program. Fortunately, that happened, but that's right. Another case.
Yeah, no, I really like that. At the end of the day, there is no reason why any one person is born smarter than another, right?
Exactly.
On average, like, I'm sure that there's there's, like, you know, small things, but in I think, like you said, it's really about what you do with what you have and the opportunity that you get, and don't be afraid. I think that's all great advice. Well, thank you very much. This has been Jiri Snacks, hosted by Karthik from MBA Link and Tyler from Achievable. Achievable has a great online GRE course you can try for free at achievable.me and use the code podcast to get 10% off if you like it.